The House Committee on Revenue for Monday, April 23rd, 2007 will come to order. We have a number of bills on our agenda, so we appreciate when people are offering testimony that if they have written testimony that they not read it, but instead give us the high points. We appreciate written testimony because as we juggle a lot of bills, it's helpful to as we go back and review that we can refresh our memories on that. But we would ask people to speak expeditiously so we can get through our agenda. House Bill 3263, which is on the agenda, will not be heard today for those who may be here on that bill. And we'll begin with a public hearing on House Bill 2641. Would you give us a summary?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2641 comes to you from the Education Committee. It deals with the local option property taxes for school districts. What it does is to increase the local option tax limits from $750 to $1,000 per weighted student, and then also from 15% to 20% of the school equalization formula revenue. So whichever of those two is the lower is the one that applies. The bill raises the limit for both. It also would index the $1,000 per weighted student limit by 3% per year beginning in 08-09. And then it also applies those new higher limits in the calculation of the local option equalization grant.
Thank you. And I note that Representative Buckley is here.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Thank you for your time and consideration of House Bill 2641A. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County. I'll tell a very quick story. This is what my perspective on it is. The school district in my hometown of Ashland is a declining enrollment district. We're losing about 100 students per year. The impact that it's having on our district, just as we struggle to try to just maintain programs, not add programs, not bring back things, but just maintain what we have. We have closed two of our five elementary schools this decade, and we are in a difficult position. The voters of Ashland have stepped up three times to pass a local option on ourselves in order to try to maintain the levels that we have with our educational offerings. But we're up against the kind of cliff on this now in terms of what we'll be able to do with our next local option. There are other districts in the state who also face similar challenges, and what this would do would make sure that local people would be able to, if they chose to put an option on themselves that would allow for a declining enrollment district to maintain services. And that is it in a nutshell. I'd be glad to answer any questions on this if I can.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just the mechanics on this, Representative Buckley, thank you very much. And incidentally, we're forwarding all of your telephone calls from Butler's office to Buckley's office.
Appreciate that.
But the mechanics, would this be within the current measures 5 and 50 limits? And help me with the mechanics, if you would, please.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, yes, it would. We made sure that this, as written, it must fall within the measure 5 limitations. This is there are not that many districts that have the opportunity to have that gap underneath the cap to be able to say they'd like to raise this amount of money in order to maintain services.
And second question, if I may.
Yes, please.
You've this decade you've lost two of your five elementary schools. Is that that's not reflective of what's happening in your community? It must just be the graying of your community. Is that what's happening?
Chair Barnhart, that's absolutely correct. Our demographic is changing radically. If I have the numbers correctly, our graduating senior class National High School is 267 this year, and our incoming kindergarten class is about 127. So that's the scale. We do have a housing crisis in Ashland, but we do actually we have a good deal of poverty in Ashland too amongst our elementary school families. We have a large portion that are on the officially provided meals program. But we do have, fortunately, a populace that is willing to step up and help pay for schools to keep the level of services.
That was my final question, Mr. Chair. Obviously, when you get this graying of the population and you're closing schools, but you need more resources, local resources, to continue to maintain the same levels, then there's some indication that maybe particularly new families moving in the community may not have the level of commitment to your school system to vote yes on these kinds of local options. So, but you're comfortable that the folks that are moving in feel strongly that they would impose the tax upon themselves in a local vote.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bellius, the voting populace of Ashland has consistently backed its schools, and I believe they will do so again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Berger.
And Mr. Chair, this isn't a question of the representative, but a question of staff. Steve, do you have any idea how many districts would qualify in your Measure 5 that would have this much capacity?
Offhand, no, I don't.
Yeah. Is it a hard thing to derive?
Measuring the difference between Measure 5 and Measure 50 is... has to be done on a property-by-property basis.
Okay.
So that's a detailed
calculation. I'm not going to ask for something, but I just wondered if there was some...
And we don't have a lot of that individual data in our office, but some.
If I may, I think the answer to the question can roughly be determined by looking at places where property values are increasing rapidly, because the Measure 5 limit then becomes different from the Measure 50 limit. Is that a reasonable... way of doing a rough estimate of it?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would be, because it the big driver is the difference between assessed value and real market value, not the tax rates, even though the gap applies to the tax difference between the two.
I can kind of derive that myself.
Yeah, that's right. It's very difficult to determine what any one levy raises because of the need to actually calculate them on a per property basis. But we can figure out whether the capacity is increasing overall pretty easily, I think.
So Mr. Chair, staff would be saying then that basically if in rural Oregon our values are not increasing by the same percentage that metropolitan or the more metropolitan areas such as Ashland or some of the other high growth areas of the state, then chances are that this would favor the more metropolitan areas over the less metropolitan, more rural areas of the state.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, I would agree with that. If real market value isn't increasing faster than assessed value, then that gap isn't growing a lot.
Okay. I know there's more than 3% a year.
Correct.
Okay.
So then, my question of you, Mr. Chair, would be: would we have a potential inequity situation relative to local tax situation to create this additional local revenue from $750 to $1,000 per student, thus providing better educational opportunities for folks in high growth value districts than you would over a lower growth?
I think that's a great question to ask Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Representative Butler, my argument back would be no, that given it's a decline in enrollment district, this is one tool a decline in enrollment district has simply to maintain services. And I think if you came to visit our school district, you'd see some very positive programs, very proud of our district. But at the same time, you would not find it to be a district that has offerings substantially different than districts statewide. So I do agree that it is a tool. It's a tool that only a certain number of districts can use because of the circumstances they find themselves under. I would argue they find themselves under those circumstances through no choice of their own. But they're doing the best they can, given every available tool, to maintain services for their students.
Other questions? I have one, and it's because the bill is fairly thick, although there aren't a whole lot of there's not a whole lot of new language in it. Can you refer me to the place where it talks about declining value or declining enrollment in the bill?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I do not believe it will say anything about declining enrollment in the bill itself. The local option is available to any district, even if a district does not have declining enrollment. It's a choice of the residents of the district where they wish to pass that option upon themselves in order to fund services. I believe there will be someone from OSBA that could answer some questions in terms of the numbers of districts that have actually voted a local option on themselves or turned down a local option on themselves. And it is a tool that is used or at least considered statewide. So,
thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. It was very helpful.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate your time and consideration. I'm also on another bill you have on your agenda today, House Bill 3514. I'd be glad to come back if you should need any testimony from me on that bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Matt Marquis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Equity Steering Committee, which is a group of six school districts from across the state that banded together shortly after Measure 5 passed to talk about equity issues across the state to make sure that all of our districts are funded equitably. We do testify with some concern to House Bill 2641 today, and while we recognize Representative Buckley's problems in Ashland with the declining enrollment, because some of our districts are declining enrollment as well. We do have some concerns, though, with the local option, because as you increase a district's local option money, it creates more disparities across the states between districts. As you talked about already today, the gap between Measure 5 and Measure 50 of what's available for some districts varies greatly. And while nobody knows exactly how much that is, I know that several years ago when we did pass the local option tax, it ranged from people having no gap whatsoever to a large amount. And while those numbers are different today, there still is a great variance between school districts across the state as to what their potential to raise is. Something that if folks of this committee are interested in the local option tax, local option as expanding that, something that you may want to consider that we would be more supportive of is to broaden the taxing authority of a school district. While some districts, for instance, along the coast may not ever be able to pass a local option property tax, but they may be able to pass something like a hotel tax kind of thing, or maybe in Eastern Oregon something even different than that works better. We obviously have issues across the state where school districts aren't funded adequately, but we just don't think this is the right approach to do so because it takes away from equity issues across the state. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I represent House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. The Corvallis School District was one of the districts where local taxpayers had generously funded their public schools and was hit especially hard by Measure 5 and is now in the unique position of people in my community pay far more in their property taxes than what it is that stays within that school district. We have successfully passed local option levies. I know that we also have a declining enrollment district. Ours would be one that would welcome the ability to further enhance local services. And I'm wondering what the Equity Committee, what they thought about in terms of their discussions about the equity of some districts taxing themselves at a higher rate but not being able to benefit from that higher rate and shipping that to other parts of the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I'm not exactly sure what you're saying. Are you saying that you have a local option now and some of that local option is going back to the state?
No, let me clarify. I'm saying under our Measure 5 limitations, our existing property tax rate, because Corvallis was a highly taxed area, we pay more in property taxes than what stays in our district. We're one of the districts whose dollars are going out to supplement in other parts of the state. So I'm wondering, given that equity formula that some of these districts are already contributing to other parts of the state, why would an equity committee want to deny those same school districts the ability to provide some resources to their own districts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I wasn't aware, and I think I understand what you're saying, that your school district raises more in property taxes and therefore contributes to the state school fund without receiving state dollars back, is I believe what you're saying. Is that right?
Obviously everybody, you keep your local dollars and that offsets what you get from the state school fund, but given what people in my legislative district pay in property taxes, they don't get an equal return back in investment in their public schools, while other communities in the state are paying less in property taxes and get a return back to their school districts, which is greater than what they're actually contributing in.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I understand what you're saying, and Corvallis isn't the only one with that unique situation, but I think because we have a state-funded system where the majority of our dollars are coming from the state, and while that may vary from district to district, how much of that comes from local money and how much of that comes from state money, I think because of our equity issues and because we have a state-funded system that we need to have some sort of mechanisms that tries to equalize the funding across the state. We do currently have a local option tax that allows $750 or 15% of what your state apportionment is, and we think that that goes far enough as far as that 15%. We're worried that when you get to 20%, that you're just going to create bigger disparities. And as folks come into this building and advocate for a state school fund of a certain dollar amount, that if you have a lot of districts that are closer to the 20%, it's a little harder for the school system as a whole to come in and advocate for a higher dollar amount.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
Thank you. So would the Equity Committee support taking away the authority of places like Multnomah County to institute local income tax? Again, larger communities like Portland Public Schools and the others have the ability to draw on large county commissions where people in places like Benton County cannot. And I think we saw in Measure 30, Measure 28, the impact of taking out all of those Portland types of voters who had been taken care of by that Multnomah County tax. And that equity, again, was not there for some of these other districts, like the district that I represent, much in the same way that you're arguing now. So I'm hopeful that, I mean, would you support taking away that authority to make it truly equal for districts like mine?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, yeah, we would be supportive of that, and we've worked against all sorts of side deals that go around the funding formula that have existed in the past, and we've been pretty committed to making sure that most all money runs through the formula rather than having separate deals outside of the formula.
Mr. Speaker?
Please.
I'd like to make a clarifying comment. I think my frustration is that we've completely removed from local school districts and local communities the ability to make choices about how it is that they want to support their communities. Some districts, whether it's due to their lower property tax value base or if it's due to the region of the state that they live in, they don't have a county commission, for example, like Multnomah County, aren't able to find alternate ways or local option levies to support them. I think that the local option levy is a good way for districts to take some local control and have individual communities build on a basic base of funding that's available through the state school fund. But it troubles me in the name of equity to deny some districts who already are contributing so much the ability to do something for the kids in their own school districts when they have seen so many losses. My school district has closed 5 schools in 5 years, and it's just wrong. They need tools to be able to fix that. And it's not equitable that they don't have the ability to do that, that they don't have the same tools as other districts, and therefore even further inequitable to take away and deny a potential tool to them on the basis of equity in that context.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions? I had a bill in that I think is sitting in another committee and hasn't moved that would have essentially given school districts general taxing authority. I take it that your group would support that bill or one like it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, I mean, in I think we're all looking for the same thing. We all want all of our schools to be funded adequately, and we do have a local option now, and our group is concerned that the more that you expand that local option, if it's only on property taxes, you create more disparities across the state. But none of us want to see schools close, and for some folks that might not be able to pass a property tax, and there's some other sort of tax that they could pass to better their school system, then we would be supportive of that.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2641? And if not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2641, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3044. Mary.
House Bill 3044 will increase the current rate component of the forest products harvest tax designated for fire suppression to 0.625 per thousand board feet. It also increases the assessments imposed on owners of timber and grazing lands for the purpose of fire protection will take effect 91 days after signed by. Currently, the forest products harvest tax is $2.61 per million or per thousand board feet, of which 50 cents per thousand board feet is designated for fire protection. However, owners of timber and grazing lands also pay assessments annually based on acreage for the size of their parcels. These assessments and the 50 cents, not $50, pardon me, portion of the forest products harvest tax are deposited into the forest land protection fund, and this fund serves basically as an insurance policy for landowners by reimbursing a fire district for the cost of fire protection after the district has satisfied an annual $25,000 deductible mm-hmm. for a single fire.
Thank you. Let's hear from Tim Keith and I'll let you two come up. I'm not able to read the second name. Oh, Bart Starker.
It's warm.
It's on the letter in typewrite. Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, and I'd like to acknowledge Representative Gelser and Andy Olson from my part of the world. So thank you. For the record, I'm Bart Starker, chair of the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, our four-person forest landowner committee appointed by the Oregon Board of Forestry. We administer the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which pays for firefighting costs on fires which escape local fire protection association initial attack and their deductibles. Here to ask for the assessments on landowners to be increased by 25% to cover the increasing costs of big wildfires in the state. There are several reasons for the increase. The primary one is that several years ago, I guess 2 years ago, the legislature changed the levels of and the shares of these big fires that are paid by landowners versus the general fund and insurance policy. Changed the initial level from $10 million to $15 million per landowner's responsibility, and changed the general fund responsibility from the next $15 million to the next $10 million. So they reduced the landowner or the general fund responsibility. And our rates for our funding, our share of our first $15 million as landowner's responsibility have not changed since 1991. And we need to adjust those rates so that we can pay a bigger share of that first $15 million. We don't want to pay the whole thing or all of it in rates because we don't spend the whole $15 million every year. We hope we don't. We better not. Or we're going to have more fire than we know what to do with. So that's the primary reason, is to bring those rates up to speed with our current responsibility. Escalation in fire severity and inflation and firefighting costs is also a major reason for doing this. And the shift in federal policy and staffing and lack of fuel treatments on federal lands, which puts the state-protected land at higher risk. More and more rural residences, and certainly Measure 37 is going to complicate firefighting tactics and significantly increase the number of fire starts in those rural areas if it plays out as it could. We looked at long-term trends to try and pick a rate that will fund the fires and not build a surplus over time. And we do have the ability to both raise rates and reduce rates depending on what the surplus or deficit is in the fund. But we thought the landowners would be happier with a more stable fund rather than one that ratchets up and down on an annual basis. So that's the primary reason. We're also working on the cost side of things, working with the Forest Service to take more responsibility for fires that move off the federal lands onto the private and state-protected lands. We're increasing initial attack and severity funding, hopefully. We're also cost collecting, got a cost collection process that where there are fires that have some liability or law violation on them, we're pursuing those to get cost collections and insurance claims and so forth on those so that we can repay the Forest Land Protection Fund. So we hope you'll agree with us that we need to change these rates to ensure that Oregon's first-class and world-class fire protection system can stay the way it is and stay as effective as it has been over the last several decades. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Our questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm getting this, what you're doing is raising about 4 cents on this 4 feet and allocating it from 50 cents to 54 cents. Mary, am I correct in that?
They're adding exactly. Here's a
from 50 cents to 54 cents.
It's 50 cents to 62.5 on the forest products.
Oh, okay. Okay, I've got the. But did I also understand your testimony that you have the authority to do this already, that you're putting it in the statute because it was requested?
When we either build up an overabundance of surplus or are in deficit, we have the rate. We can change the rates administratively.
But you're choosing to do it this way.
We think that our landowners should be much happier with a more stable rate rather than one that jumps up and down on an annual basis.
Okay, I understand. That helps a lot.
That makes sense. Did you have testimony to give?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name's Tim Keith, administrator of the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, and I'm here to support Bart and help answer questions as all.
Thank you. That's what somehow I had that impression. Did you have one, Representative Witt?
No question, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to recognize Mr. Starker's many years of service on our state's fire committee and his volunteer efforts to help protect our state's forest lands from wildfire, and thank him for all those years of service and his dedication.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Wayne. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One brief question relative to the bill. Do we have the folks that own the small forest lots and so forth, are those folks at the table with you on this? Are they in support of it? Have they testified in the other committee in support of it?
Yes, they have. We think they're on board.
Excellent. And follow up, if I
yes,
may.
Please. Yeah.
This is an administrative question more than anything else. Typically, we see this go to, this is an issue which has been before the Ways and Means in the past, the appropriation, because the emergency funds include the final amounts which will be included for firefighting in the interim. And, of course, I recognize this is a kind of a strange year for an interim anyway, because we'll be meeting in February of 2008. My question is, does this have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Butler, it probably should have one because the first part deals with the forest products harvest tax, and mm-hmm. in years past, that portion, the 50-cent rate for fire suppression, has remained constant. So I would think that if someone's envisioning or proposing to change the suppression rate, it would probably need one, but it hasn't got one right now.
And thank you. And, Mr. Chair, my concern is that as in the past when we've talked about the forest product harvest tax, it's always eventually because of the final result of setting the money aside to fight fires, in the interim has been a Ways and Means function. So. That probably before the bill leaves the committee, we're not working it today, I see, but before it left this committee, probably needs to have a subsequent referral.
Should we check on that? Mm-hmm. Would you check on that? And let's see if that, there may have been a reason why they left it off this time. I don't know what it is, and we'll find out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? I just want to make certain that I understand that last time or the time before, sessions run together for me after a while. We made a major change in the way in which costs are allocated between the state and the private owners. This does not make any change to that system, does it?
Does not.
There was a lot of conversation about it. We had at least one organization that argued in exactly the opposite way in which the bill affected things, and it was very confusing. So I'm glad we're not opening that up again. Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Thank you. Thank you very much. And may I add my comment to that of Mr. Representative Witt?
Thank you.
Thank you. Charlie Stone, Ray Wilkerson.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Charlie Stone. I'm a policy analyst for the Protection from Fire program for the Department of Forestry. The Emergency Fire Cost Committee is actually operates under a separate authority from the Department of Forestry. We're closely linked and we work together on this, but because they are separate entities, I'm here to also lend the Department of Forestry support to House Bill 3044. I would mention, because I don't have a whole lot of original additional information to give, but the attachment to my written testimony shows a table of the several different revenues that we're talking about here and what is currently raised under the current rates, what would be additionally raised to that. So basically we're talking about annual income to the fund going from $8.2 million to $10.3 million in order to better close the gap between the that and the $15 million obligation that the landowners might meet. I'd also, to the question about whether this needs to go to Ways and Means, and ultimately I don't know the answer to that. You'll certainly find that out. But I think part of the thinking in sending it to Revenue and on is that we aren't changing the system through this bill. That the way that we pay for large fires was established in the last session, and this now responds to saying, you know, there's a larger obligation. Where's that money going to come from? The landowners have asked to raise their contribution on a regular, stable basis rather than up and down as the fire seasons go. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Stone.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need to confirm then, Mr. Stone, it's your testimony that the landowners have come forward and have agreed to this additional approximately $2.1 million of additional assessment against them. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, the Emergency Fire Cost Committee is made up of landowners who have the responsibility to mine that fund. All the revenues that go into that fund are from landowner assessments and taxes, and both the Oregon Forest Industries Council, as we'll hear, and the small woodland owners have worked with that committee, and as far as we know, are in support of it.
Thank you. Thank you. And yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add my support for this idea as well. The Forest Land Protection Fund is something that I've come to appreciate. I knew nothing about it until about a year and a half ago when it became an issue in my community. And I was quite honestly terrified when I learned about the dangers to residents living in kind of the urban-rural interface where you've got treed areas and houses close together on very sloped areas. And we absolutely need to be investing appropriately to protect our forest lands, to protect the individuals that are living in those homes, and also to financially protect the individuals who are paying these assessments. When they're not assessed and they're not paying in, they become individually responsible for fires that start on their own property, which can go up into the millions of dollars. So this is it's a good deal for everybody for a very small amount of money.
Thank you. I think what you said a moment ago is that you're not sure this will have any effect on the appropriations that the Ways and Means Committee is considering. And if that's the case, it may not actually need a Ways and Means referral, but we'll find out.
Thank you. That is my testimony.
Yeah, thank you. Ray?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. We represent large private forest landowners in Oregon, and I'm here in support of this bill. As Mr. Stone just said, the Emergency Fire Cost Committee, which brought this bill to the legislature, is a four-person committee. Three of those four people are representatives of companies who are also members of OFIC. The fourth is a representative of the Small Woodlands Association or Small Woodland Owners, and all four of the members of that committee recommended that this adjustment to the rate structure to this fund be brought to your attention and hopefully for your approval. So that's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you give us just a little bit more about why the large holders would support a 25% increase in their assessment?
Mr. Chairman, the real driver of this program is not the tax rate, it's the cap. The maximum annual exposure, the cost exposure in this fund used to be $10 million annual. That's as much as it possibly could be. Beyond that, it's the responsibility of the state of Oregon to cover costs. That cap was raised to $15 million by the legislature last time, and as a result of that, there's a large gap between the revenue stream and the potential exposure to the fund. So it seemed prudent to try to narrow that gap, even it out a little bit, by increasing revenues by 25%. It's still not, if you use up the whole $15 million, the revenue is still not adequate, but it'd be more adequate than it would be if this bill didn't pass.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3044? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3044 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3468. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3468 creates a privilege tax, $0.02 per thousand board feet of mercantile forest products for the purpose of administering Oregon's smoke management plan in the amount not to exceed 40% of total expenditures approved by the Legislative Assembly. It applies to the forest products harvest tax. Reporting periods were beginning January 1, 2008, and in addition, in lieu of other appropriations, there's appropriated to the State Forestry Department for the purpose of forest smoke management another $240,000 for the biennium beginning July 1, 2007. We'll say that as background, the Oregon Smoke Management Plan, developed as a voluntary program in 1969, has been subsequently adopted as a regulatory program by the State Forester and the Environmental Quality Commission. The plan, which applies to state, federal, and private forest land, currently includes mandatory smoke management constraints for burning in western Oregon, and the voluntary programs are in effect in Klamath Falls and Lakeview areas.
Thank you. And we have the same cast of characters, or at least some of them, for this one. Mr. Stone, Mr. Wilkerson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Charlie Stone with the Department of Forestry. House Bill 3468, as you've heard, would raise additional revenues for the smoke management program. Since its inception back in the late 60s, early 70s, for a lot of the time, the smoke management program has been housed within the Forest Practices Program of the Department of Forestry, and also for a large part of that time, it's been funded by a 60-40 matching of 60% general fund dollars, 40% harvest taxes. In 1991, the program was expanding. There were some ideas about how to improve on it and help to develop alternatives to burning, carry out the program in a more efficient way. In order to do that, burn fees were added to the program, where the landowners who were preparing to do prescribed burning would pay a registration fee and then ultimately an accomplishment fee when they completed the burning. In 2003, after the general fund shortfalls, the general fund portion that was part of that mix was completely removed from the program, and consequently the harvest tax that matches it was not used anymore. So for the last 4 years, the program has been operating entirely off of burn fees from the landowners. This bill is an effort and a recommendation from a smoke management review committee that's operated for quite some time to try and restore that funding formula, where we continue to have burn fees pay for about 50% of the program, but by instituting a 2 cent per thousand board foot harvest tax, it would raise $160,000 per biennium, and a $240,000 general fund appropriation, again 60-40 matching on that portion of it. We'd have 50% burn fees roughly, 20% harvest tax, and 30% general fund going into the program. It would allow us to improve some of the technologies that are used in weather forecasting to do the smoke management program, allow us to institute a an additional position, a fuel specialist, field coordinator person who can go around the state, help people to find alternatives to burning and minimize the amount of burning and emissions in the program and other improvements to the program. So we ask that you look on this favorably, and this one does have another referral to Ways and Means, and we'd hope that you'd send it on to them with a due pass recommendation. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? Ray?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson again, Oregon Forest Industries Council. My purpose here is the same as on the last bill, to indicate the support of OFIC for this bill. It basically, this is a small program that kind of got kicked around a little bit during the downturn in the budget the last several sessions, like a lot of other programs the state government did, and this is a bill that attempts to return it to some semblance of its former funding structure. So we support sending this to Ways and Means. I will tell you, however, that our support is for the harvest tax piece is conditional on the Ways and Means Committee providing the general fund the $240,000 that would be requested in this bill, so we'll be watching it as it if and when it comes out of there to see what shape it's in. But the funding mix as proposed by this bill is something that we support.
Thank you very much. I would note that on the top of page 2 there's a limitation on expenditures that I think deals with the issue, and also, of course, section 6 actually appropriates the funds from the general fund, and that's what you're talking about, isn't it?
That's right, Mr. Chairman. The bill contemplates a $240,000 general fund appropriation. And
right. And so this tax would collect about two-thirds of that amount. Is that what we think?
That's right, Mr. Chairman. And that, as Mr. Stone indicated, would basically turn this program to how it was formerly funded through the same ratio funding ratio that's in the Forest Practices Program right now, which is 60% general fund, 40% harvest tax. That's the intent of the bill, is to fold this into that same ratio.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ray, Charlie, if in the process our biofuels are able to finally harvest some of that understory from the forests and move it actually into biodiesel or other biofuels, will this 2 cents continue on if we move it into statute, even though it may not be necessary, because you wouldn't be burning that understory if we found it to be feasible to pull that out and convert it?
That's a very good question, Representative Butler. I personally hadn't thought about what the answer might be. I think the answer is probably it would still apply. The harvest tax applies to all trees harvested in the state of Oregon for a commercial purpose, and I think biofuels would be considered a commercial purpose if the landowner is making a profit on the enterprise. But that's a good question. I'm not sure that I'm right in what I just said.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, I think another part maybe to that question is would it still be necessary? And I think we certainly encourage any means to use more of the material and burn less, but given the ecology of our forests, we don't believe that there will ever be a time when it's still not necessary to do some burning. We'll be able to burn with a lot lower emissions and a lot less material going up in smoke, but in order to sanitize the forest, in order to deal with areas where you just can't get to that material, burning will still be a necessary element. And yes, hopefully the amount of material will be less, the need for the program somewhat less, but this would still go on, we believe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3468? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3468, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2849. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2849 deals with small remote school qualifications. Currently, there are several qualifications that a small elementary school has to meet to qualify for additional student weights in the school equalization formula. It has to exist as a small school in have existed as a small school in 1995, have the location unchanged since 95, be below a certain student count depending on the number of grades that it serves, and be more than 8 miles to the nearest elementary school. This last distance requirement is what the bill addresses. Rather than being 8 miles to the nearest elementary school, it has to be more than 8 miles from the nearest school, elementary school within the district. So that language within the district is added, so that it could be closer than 8 miles to a elementary school in an adjoining school district. The other thing the bill does is to make a change for the qualification of charter schools. Charter school would qualify if it was a remote small school on the effective date of this legislation, not the July 18th, 1995 date currently in the statutes, and then would also meet the condition that the location has not changed in 95. So it would have to be a converted public school to meet that condition. But that this last condition is not being changed.
Thank you. Representatives? We're going to hear from the sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath. Representative Boquist and I are the co-sponsors of this bill, which would make a minor change, and I would say that it's something akin to minor surgery, which is something that happens to someone that's not you, is what minor surgery is. I don't think there's any such thing as a minor change to the state school funding formula, depending upon who it is that you ask. But this is intended to be a small change that would protect some of our small rural schools. And essentially it says that the distance requirement of a small elementary school, which is being at least 8 miles away from another school, be clarified to state that at least 8 miles away from another school in that school's school district. The reason that I introduced and brought this bill came from an experience I had as a school board member in Corvallis. We had a small rural school called Innavale, which we did close. It was very small. It is about 9 miles away from the closest school in our school district. However, it was about 7.8 miles away from a school in a neighboring school district. For the students in that school, they would not have transportation to go to that school in that neighboring school district, so they really weren't any better off by that proximity. It is my understanding that there are not a lot of these schools left where they are small and in this circumstance, and while it certainly would change the state school fund distribution formula by shifting some additional resources to these schools, I think that it is an important investment in maintaining some of these small rural schools. In my district, this was a school that served many farm families. It was one of the only community centers for that rural part of Benton County, and it really was a loss to our school district and a loss to our community to see that school go away. This would help to preserve a couple of those schools that are still remaining without an overwhelmingly significant impact upon other schools. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gelser, you might share too with the committee, I mean, that what that school did, not just for the impact, but for the academics and for the students and involvement. And I mean, in my understanding, they excelled just tremendous.
Yes, thank you for that question, Representative Olson, Mr. Chair. The school that was closed, I think that our experience was similar to other school districts who have closed schools. The schools that closed were not necessarily failing schools. In the case of this school, that was one of the hardest votes I've ever cast, was one to close this school, which was rated exceptional. Its students were excelling in all areas. However, because of the small number of children that were there, it was increasingly difficult to meet the academic needs of those kids. It got to the point where we had parents volunteering to teach things like math and science, and you simply can't maintain a public school in that in that kind of a way. So it really was a loss. It was also a school that was very innovative in using its kind of its sense of place. It was a school that was based on sense of place, and they really utilized the natural resources that were available to them in their rural community. They worked with the local farmers, and I think that's something that you would see similarly in some of these other small rural schools that are just on the outskirts of a school district. It was frustrating as I worked with that group. I talked with the Department of Education to try to figure out why the school was not eligible for these additional funds that certainly would have made a difference in the ability to maintain that school. And it was this distance issue, and it was mind-boggling to me that for 0.2 mile for another school that wasn't even in our school district, that the kids in that school lost out on the opportunity for the supplemental funding.
So that school is gone.
That school is gone. That school closed at the end of the school year last spring.
Yeah, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, had they qualified for the supplemental funding, would they be there today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think that there, I don't know for sure the answer to that question. We were not able to get to the place to be able to figure out what the funding would be and balance that part out. I can't say for certain that it would. I think that it certainly would have boosted their case. If I remember correctly, the additional funds to that school would have been, the formula was very complicated to figure out. It was somewhere on the order of $50,000. The savings to the district annually was on the order of $125,000. So it's hard to tell what the board would have decided in terms of what that breaking point was for the loss of the school.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, yes. Could I ask staff again, does he have a notion of how many schools are?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I do not at this time. Whether I could find that out is debatable. I don't know. The Department of Education only has the mileage required between districts. If it's between that 8 and 12, it's usually either more than 12, and when it's under 8, and whether it's the district adjoining or the district within that 8 miles is in the same district or not, it's
complicated. Thank you.
Yes.
Like everything around the school funding,
basically, we'd have to check.
Complicated, and
you'd have to check with the individual schools.
My only concern here is unintended consequences, and I'm trying to think this through, and it's. Thank you,
Representative Berger. And I want to clarify, this issue was brought to my attention by the circumstance, and I want to be clear that I'm not certain that if this was the case that school would still be open. It might be, but I don't know for sure, so I'm glad that you asked that question.
And we don't know that this actually affects any schools that are currently operating, do we?
Mr. Chair, representatives, members of the committee, I believe that it does impact some schools. I have had a conversation with one individual that indicated some of these schools have closed, that there are only a handful of these of such schools left that would fall into this circumstance. And it seems to me that the number that was given to me was in the teens, but I can certainly go back and try to find that out.
I think that might be helpful.
Mr. Chair, also as the number of students in these borderline schools declines, there might be new ones that would fall into the remote small school category that aren't now.
That's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you, Representative. We appreciate your bringing this bill.
Thank you for hearing it.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2849? Yes, sir. Come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Reeder from the Department of Education. Just wanted to help clarify a couple things. The department hasn't taken a position on this bill, but Steve just mentioned that there may be additional schools that didn't exist back in 95 that under this bill might newly qualify for small school correction. And if you look at page 2 of the bill, Section 7 sub A, I believe that language is the language that would make that possible. What that language does is change the effective date to the passage of this bill as opposed to July 18th of 1995. So it's conceivable, for example, that a school that existed back in 95 but didn't qualify because it was too large has now shrunk in size due to declining enrollment, and now with this new effective date would now qualify for the small school correction. And I know of at least one school in the state that falls into that circumstance, and there may or very likely be others as well. So just wanted to make the committee aware that in addition to bringing in schools that are close to a school in a neighboring district but not to a school in their own, this bill may also bring in additional schools to become eligible for the small school correction.
Okay, thank you. This is not a dynamic analysis, is it? The thing is based on qualification on a certain date, and the bill moves the date.
Chair Barnhart, that's correct, and I believe the purpose of putting that date in there in the first place, the 1995 date, is so that we would not have new schools qualifying, so that we weren't encouraging the formation of very small, what some people would consider inefficiently small schools, that we were willing to make more resources available to those that already existed, but that we didn't want to encourage more of those to be formed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if the requirement that the school would already be qualified as a remote small school on the day that this act is effective wouldn't help mitigate against schools trying to be formed that would meet that criteria. Those schools would have to already be in existence, and there hasn't been any incentive for them to do that to date. So it would just be those that, by circumstances, you mentioned declining enrollment districts or others, that would face that circumstance.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Gelser, that's correct. I would agree with that. It's unlikely, given that the effective date of this is July 1st of 07, it's highly unlikely that we're going to find some schools forming between now and then simply to take advantage of this. But you're correct. They're the ones I mentioned that, by circumstance, didn't qualify back in 95 but would today, would be newly qualified under this bill.
And if you look at the first part of that sentence, you realize the school had to have been in existence on January 1, 1995, and that it can't have moved in the meantime, even with the new language.
Chair Barnhart, I...
Only if the location of the school has not changed since January 1, 1995.
In my mind, that language may be a bit ambiguous. It has a new school that was formed, for example, in 1997. Could you say it has not moved since 95, or would you say that it has moved since 95?
Good question.
Depending on the intent, that language may want to be clarified to make it clear that either a school that was newly formed after that date either does or doesn't qualify.
Thank you. I think that's a good point. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2849? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2849, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3514. Representative?
Deja vu all over again. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County, bring to you House Bill 3514. It's a one-pager, but it should have an impact. In a nutshell, what this bill would do would eliminate the ability for an employer to take a tax deduction for wages paid to undocumented workers in the state of Oregon. And that's it.
I think we'll hear from Steve. I'm sorry, for Chris. People moved in. I missed it. Who it was who moved in. Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, all I had was a summary, and the representative just summarized it pretty succinctly. It does define an undocumented worker as an employee for whom the employer is unable to verify as a legal resident of the United States. So there's a definition piece in there. It would affect businesses taxed on both the personal income tax side as well as the corporate tax side, so all business structures. And the wages in question are the when the employers calculate their tax, the one of the costs of doing businesses are the compensation paid to the employees. This would simply disallow that deduction, and so the employers would then face potentially a tax increase. Their tax liability would increase as a result of not being able to take that deduction.
Thank you. That's useful. Representative, currently, under current federal law, employers are required to keep this kind of record documentation, are they not?
That's my
name. I guess I should ask the question a different way. Does this change the documentation requirement that they have to comply with already under current federal law? Maybe not tax law, but current law?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, it's my understanding this would not change it, that they are required to document their workers and to document that they are legally here and have legal status to be employed.
So in order to lose the tax deduction, one would have to violate the federal law that requires you to document that your workers are actually legal workers.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, that's correct.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I have a mechanical question how you go about this.
Good question.
The concern that I've got is that right now, all workers, before they're able to receive or to complete the W-4, they've got to complete an I-9, at which point the worker provides two forms of identification. I'm concerned if the two forms of identification, if you question those forms of identification if an employer questions the forms of identification and says, is this a real driver's license? Is this a real passport from this country? Is this a real immigration green card? Then they could be subject to rather significant penalties under federal law at present. Tell me how we get our employers around that kind of originally when we moved from just W-4 information to actually W-9 or I-9 immigration form 9 mandatory forms of identification. The kid that went to high school was born and raised down the block and went to high school, comes and applies for a clerk's job in a convenience store, and you say, I got to see a copy of your birth certificate, I got to see a copy of these that I'm going to keep for my file. I know who you are, but I keep those in the file. And I'm assuming that for that youngster that I've known all my life, or I've known all his life, that those will be authenticated documents. It's the other folks that walk in, hand me a green card, hand me a Social Security card, and hand me another form of ID, and I shoot copies of those to protect my file. How do I make that happen so that I'm making the employer presently liable for something that they've never been liable for?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Butler, that's an excellent point, and I would agree with you. This is a push in terms of what we face with the illegal immigration and the concern of illegal workers taking American workers' jobs. This would put a requirement on an employer to do their utmost to verify that the people they're hiring are indeed legal. There are programs being started now by the federal government that will be available eventually where Social Security numbers can be checked and verified, and we would anticipate that employers would take advantage of those types of programs. But again, this is simply and I agree, this does put an extra burden on an employer to make that push to make sure they are hiring people that they know are documented.
My next question would then be,
please.
Thank you, if I may, Mr. Chair. My next question would then be, what of the farm labor contractors? The farm labor contractor comes in and authenticates to the farmer that they will do 40 acres of onions or sugar beets or whatever needs to be done, and that they will have documented workers. Not knowing which of the workers might be documented or undocumented, But the farm labor contractor then bills 115% of the total labor bill to the farmer. My concern is, who loses the deduction? Will the farmer lose the deduction at that point, or will the farm labor contractor, which typically isn't even an Oregon resident, will they lose that deduction?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Butler, my understanding is that this would only apply to Oregon employers, and it would be whoever took the deduction from their taxes. So if it was the employment company that provided the labor, they would be the ones who would be unable to take that deduction again. And I would point out, too, that this would require people to actually be caught through an auditing of somehow that they had slipped up and employed people and then take a deduction for employing someone who was not legal.
The statute very clearly refers to an employee of the taxpayer. So in the example you gave, the
farm labor contractor.
The taxpayer is the farm labor contractor, not the farmer who has the contract.
Yeah.
And so the farmer has delegated any responsibility he might have to the farm labor contractor to make sure he's got documented work.
Does the bill provide for the mechanics of how that undocumented labor is actually verified then?
Well, it does say, line 2021, an employee of the taxpayer from the taxpayer does not have records or is otherwise unable to verify that the employee is a legal resident of the United States. I don't know that the mechanics are stated in the bill, but that's pretty clear, isn't it?
So if they have the I-9 information on hand, which is now currently their legal responsibility, then that's really all that's mandatory then.
Chair Barr, that's correct. Basically, this bill is basically saying if someone is already breaking the law by not requiring the proper identification, they cannot also take a tax deduction for their efforts.
Well, people who are complying with the federal law will automatically get the deduction under this law.
Correct. Sure.
Other questions for the representative? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony yet again today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
We have Erica Steinbauer and Larry Kleinman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erica Steinbauer. I'm coordinator of CAUSA, which is a statewide immigrant rights coalition here in Oregon. And we wish to oppose HB 3514 in its present form, but we would withdraw our opposition under a couple conditions. First of all, we'd like to propose an amendment that would help clarify the bill, we feel. And actually, when we were sitting here, we revised our wording a little bit, so I'm going to read to you something slightly different than what's in my written testimony. We would suggest amending HB 3514 as follows. Delete line 8 starting after if through 12, and also the identical lines 18 also after if through 22, and in each case replace with the taxpayer has been convicted or found in violation of 8 U.S.C. section 1324 small a f, which is an immigration law regarding employment incident to which wages were paid. This amendment would provide clarity to ambiguous wording that leaves room for misinterpretation and thereby unintended and unjust outcomes. As currently worded, HB 3514 doesn't have any good faith exception and could inadvertently affect U.S. citizens or legal immigrants through their employers. To warrant penalties imposed by HB 3514, the employer should have been convicted for knowing and deliberate infractions under federal law. Also, we would withdraw opposition for HB 3514 as amended if it moved forward as part of a more comprehensive legislative strategy and agenda, which would be fashioned within the limits of state powers to address immigration issues and policies affecting the immigrant community in Oregon. Additionally, we call for passage of HB 2827 and HJM 11, which would condition Oregon's implementation of the Real ID Act on making certain requirements, especially by the federal government. Passage of HB 3392, which provides certain protections for day laborers, and SJM 4 and SJR 12, which urge Congress to prioritize family reunification and immigration reform. We call for and welcome statements of legislative support for enacting comprehensive immigration reform, given that legislative action on the core issues of immigration resides at the federal and not the state level. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Larry Kleinman. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, PECUN, Oregon's Farmworker Union. And I've come here today without prepared testimony, but to join with Erica as a leader of CAUSA to support CAUSA's testimony, but also possibly to answer your questions since we are proposing specific wording and wanted to be able to answer whatever questions you might have about it.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative.
Just a clarification to Erica. You mentioned, if I understand, two conditions for your, I guess, approval or acceptance of the bill. One was the amendment language, and the second, you listed a host of bills which are in here. Are you saying your support is contingent upon passage of all these other bills, i.e., even with the amendment, you won't support 3514 without the passage of the, as you say, the comprehensive?
Our understanding is that there's a number of other bills that are moving through the legislature, and we understand that these bills aren't actually under the authority of this committee, but we just wanted to state for the record going forward that it's important to us that it's part of a larger strategy.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on that, so you're interested in seeing that the legislature actually pursues a broader avenue. This might be a piece of it, but you'd like us to have done some other things as well, and the things you've listed here.
Yeah, we're very concerned about issues facing families and workers in Oregon, and are working at the federal level to change some of the problematic immigration laws, but feel that if the state's going to be taking actions such as this bill, we should be looking more holistically at the problem.
Thank you. Other questions? Yeah, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Erica, in that regard then, do we have a number of Oregon employers who are being that are in fact violating the federal law of the I-9 and are not receiving the necessary documentation or that they know the documentation is false, or what's happening there? If we make a bill that's predicated based upon the implementation of federal statute and the federal government is turning a blind eye to it, then it's a wink and a nod. It's all the same to a blind man.
If I might answer that, Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, we don't have statistics for you about what the district, the ICE or Immigration Customs Enforcement Service is doing in this district in Oregon, but I don't think it's advisable to have the State Department of Revenue get involved in figuring out how to enforce I-9 standards. I think that we have a federal agency that's in charge of doing that. They may or may not be doing their job. If they're not doing their job, that matter should be taken up by the appropriate accountability on a federal level, and so that the state, which is your Department of Revenue, our Department of Revenue, which is in charge of revenue enforcement and collection, has a res judicata or an accomplished fact handed to them by the appropriate authority that they do not have to relitigate on their level. Excuse me. So that's how I would answer your question.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. We've just sort of zipped through all these bills. Is there further kind of discussion on this bill while we're here? Anybody ready to take the punt? All right.
Chair, I fully agree with the last two folks that have come forward. My concern is that I just don't know how we enforce on Oregon companies a greater level of responsibility to be the enforcers of this. This appears to be a phony piece of ID. And if I could find my Social Security card, my original Social Security card, in one of my old wallets, and it's there somewhere, you're going to look at it and say, that's got to have been phonied up because it's been through the wash too many times, you know, to have been a real piece of ID. So I guess I'm concerned about having that enforced upon Oregon employers to have a greater level of responsibility to determine the authenticity of I-9 information, which is a federal level of information.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to note for the record that Representative Butler is the only person I know who probably has every wallet he ever owned.
So it may take a while for him to look through
right here.
He hasn't had very many. This one,
this one came from high school. It's still around.
It's probably in there somewhere, Representative. The card you're looking for is probably in there somewhere.
That was with the IBM card or something, too.
Before we get too far afield, is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3514? And not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3514. And I think we've exhausted our agenda. We have. Committee's adjourned.